Welcome back to this Tuesday's Across the Movie Aisle, presented by Bulwark Plus. I'm your host, Sonny Bunch, culture editor of The Bulwark. I'm joined, as always, by the award-winning Alyssa Rosenberg of The Washington Post and Peter Sudeman of Reason Magazine. Alyssa, Peter, how are you today?
I'm peachy.
I am so happy to be talking about movies with friends.
First up in controversies and non-troversies, R.I.P. Max! And welcome back to HBO Max. That's right. The brain geniuses at Warner Brothers Discovery finally realized that the HBO brand is good and valuable, and that ditching it from their name was an enormous mistake. I don't want this whole segment to be an Across the Movie Aisle victory lap, but I do think it's worth pointing out that we all thought this move was completely insane way back in April of 2023 when it was first announced. The moves from HBO to HBO Go to HBO Max to Max back to HBO Max suggests that no one has any idea what they're doing over there. Let me temper that slightly. They have some idea. Like, I can construct a theoretical argument for it from the C-suite's point of view. This is what they said. I want to steel man this for them. Here it is. HBO is a signifier of quality, which is good for appealing to elite audiences with lots of disposable income. And indeed, HBO is very good at capturing that audience, right? HBO itself tossed off a couple $1 billion of profit every year when it was purchased by AT&T back in the late, when was that, 2010s? Anyway, that very signal of quality also put a ceiling on the audience level. Some people aren't interested in quality. That's not what they want from TV. And that's why HBO shows don't put up Big Bang Theory numbers. They put up The Wire numbers or Deadwood numbers. Warner Brothers Discovery wants to be Netflix-sized. They want their streamer to be Netflix-sized. And if you want your streamer to be Netflix-sized, you got to get rid of that ceiling. Okay, so you get rid of HBO, the name. Even granting all that, the move is one of the weirdest efforts at brand destruction I have ever seen. HBO is one of the few names in distribution that actually means something to audiences. It's up there with Disney as a differentiator. Like, I couldn't tell you what an ABC show looks like. I couldn't tell you what a Netflix show looks like. But I could absolutely imagine what an HBO original means. I know what it means. It means it's going to be good. It means I want to watch it. Anyway, they're changing the name back and they're having some fun at their own expense on social media with it. And that's the smart play because the whole thing is ridiculous. But it's also just good marketing to do this at the television upfronts where all this was announced, because HBO Max doesn't really have anything huge to announce. No football, no basketball, no big shows on the horizon. And while the channel remains my go-to, I mean, it really is probably the streamer I watch the most. Just recently, you had The Righteous Gemstones, which wrapped up. Hacks is on right now. The Last of Us is my only appointment viewing every weekend. An inordinate amount of my time each week really is spent on the streamer. So I shouldn't complain too much. I can understand why folks there might be a little bit nervous. Peter, I said I didn't want this to be entirely about spiking the football, but if you could spike football just a little bit more for us on this retrenchment, this return to HBO Max, I would appreciate it.
Well, I mean, I think this is a big loss for Across the Movie Aisle listeners, actually, because it means that this is the last podcast that they're going to hear Max, which is, in fact, how I've heard, like, when I read when I see the app on my television, when I read about it in Variety, for the last year or whatever, it's just like it always like plays in the Sonny Bunch voice, like Max, like a little goat. Right. And we're going to lose the Billy Goat here. And so we shouldn't spike the football because this is a big loss for us. It's like one of the best recurring jokes on this podcast because I go on podcasts, but don't always listen to them. And I especially don't listen to podcasts in which I am on them unless I really have to. I did not go back and listen to the initial episode, but it's possible that I kind of sort of defended it basically along the lines of your Steel Man case there, that like, HBO is a great brand, but it's also a relatively niche brand that appeals to a small number of people. But this was obviously a dumb move. Like, certainly in retrospect, they were not able to pull off the Steel Man case version of this that you made, where they sort of somehow, right? Like, somehow Palpatine returned, like somehow Max becomes Netflix, right? Like, that was their theory, was like, we'll change it to Max and then it will be Netflix sized. And it doesn't just work like that. You can't just be like, it's Max now, therefore everyone will subscribe. This is the streamer you are looking for style or something like that. I know Disney owns own Star Wars and not and HBO and Warner Brothers do not. But like, they basically decided this was a plan that to try to expand the brand by dropping the thing that made their brand most distinctive, by dropping the thing that everybody did know and trying to and like basically throwing out the brand recognition, the good, high value brand recognition that they had spent decades building. And that is like, that's a thing I think you see frequently in mismanaged brands that go wrong. And you've seen this, with like Nike NFL stuff, like recently, right? Like where if you want to expand the brand, the way you do that is not by ignoring or irritating your core customers that already like you. You have to keep those people, because if you start turning off the people who really like you already, you are almost certainly not going to replace them with a much bigger group of people who, at very best, in this case, like in this scenario, the best case scenario was that you were going to get rid of a group of people who really liked you and were willing to spend actually quite a bit of money, because in most cases, the relatively elite sort of high earning audience that they were pitching themselves towards is affluent. And they wanted to replace their somewhat smaller affluent audience with a much bigger, much less affluent audience. The less affluent audience is almost certainly going to care less, going to just be less engaged with your product, in part because the product is designed to be less engaging. Dr. Pimple Popper is not a show that has deep, hardcore fans who think about it for 20 years. The Wire, despite having really quite low ratings when it aired, is a show that like people still talk about today because they are deeply engaged with that brand, because they have a strong personal commitment that also translates into dollars that they are willing to spend. And so this was, again, your Steel Man case might even have been the one I made initially when this was announced. Like, yes, you can kind of understand it, but this was obviously a bad move, because the thing you don't do when you have a good, successful brand is try to expand that brand by getting rid of your core customers who already like you. Never do that. Make sure those people are happy, because if they turn on you, your brand is screwed.
Well, and Alyssa, it's a weird situation too, because you could, I think, pretty credibly argue that nothing really changed when they changed the name from HBO Max to Max, right? Like nothing in the actual programming on the streamer changed. They had already moved all the, you know, Discovery Channel stuff over, and the HGTV stuff, and the, you know, the Dr. Pimple Popper and the Home Improvements and your Property Hunters, et cetera, et cetera. That was all living on the app when they made the name change. HBO still makes a lot of stuff. HBO still makes a lot of very good stuff. HBO is still like the name of quality. It was just a hub on the streamer. So like in theory, the content, for lack of a better, less offensive word than that to describe TV shows, is the same. It's just this weird signal to everyone, like, we don't really like the name HBO. Like, we don't want to be associated with that anymore, which is, again, it's just a very strange move.
I have three sort of very disparate thoughts on this story. First, part of what is funny about all of this is that, you know, HBO's brand wasn't originally high end and classy and expensive, right? Mm-hmm. It was like sexy. It was a little trashy. It was real sex and, you know, late night. And it was home box office. It was unedited movies. And so, you know,
Tales from the Crypt.
Yes. So to a certain extent, putting all this stuff back under the HBO banner was kind of like, in some ways, a return to the roots. Second, I always found the Max branding kind of stupid, separate from whether or not it was attached to HBO, not least because I think part of what they wanted to do under this streaming service was make it sort of more female friendly, right? Like the idea you were sort of bringing in, you know, the home renovation content and some of the reality. And like, I always found the Max branding just like weirdly connect. I mean, there is a tendency towards like maxing in a lot of areas of life today. It's like, you know, weird dudes on the internet who are into like looks maxing, people who are like protein maxing, longevity maxing. It's like, I feel like maxing itself doesn't have sort of a great brand. It seems like weird and obsessive. But third, I think part of what has been strange about the treatment of Max is something that's been strange about the streaming economy in general. And I've been thinking about this in part because Warren Buffett recently announced that he was going to step down as the head of Berkshire Hathaway. And, you know, part of the lesson of Berkshire Hathaway is that it can be awesome to be a boring conglomerate, right? Like, you have a bunch of lines, like, really stable business. You don't have to, like, you know, you buy and hold. You look for things that have value. And the weird thing about everyone wanting to be Netflix is that Netflix has to be huge because it has one line of business, right? Like, it just rents you streaming content. And their ability to make that streaming content was fueled by what was very cheap money for a long time. But they don't have another business, right? I mean, they have some, there are some stabs at like a live events business, comedy, et cetera. But like, they do one thing. And if you're Warner Brothers, you are like, you are a conglomerate, right? Like, you have a bunch of different, you know, television businesses. You make movies that, you know, you can distribute in theaters and then make money from again. You know, there's a real value to not having your business all be dependent on one thing. And I understand why everybody wanted to be Netflix, right? Like, that was sort of the mandate that Wall Street was giving entertainment companies for a long time. It was like, if you try to become Netflix, we will jack up your share price. But in terms of like what's a fundamentally good business, I kind of stand by the thing that I've been saying for years about, you know, sort of Hollywood's addiction to the streaming economy. It is good to have multiple lines of business and to be able to remonetize your products over and over and over again. And so the desire to be Netflix has always struck me as fundamentally stupid, not just because, like, you know, Netflix for a while like wanted to be in the Oscar business. It still sort of does. But like, you know, if you're HBO, you get to be in the business of making stuff that everyone respects and thinks is great, and you make a healthy amount of cash, and you're one of many businesses in your big conglomerate. So maybe sometimes when you have a foul year, you can be subsidized and it all ends up okay. I think it's much better to be like a big, boring entertainment conglomerate than to have to be Netflix. But what do I know? I'm just a journalist for The Washington Post.
Hey, I'll push back on that slightly, because Warner Brothers is not like, say, a Disney, right? Where Disney has not just the movies in theatrical release, and it doesn't just have the streaming company. It also has theme parks and cruise ships, right? Like, the real business of Disney is actually the theme parks. Like, that is where most of the money from that for that company is made and kind of exists.
Which makes Disney's desire to become Netflix even stranger than Warner Brothers' desire to be Netflix, right? I mean, I just...
Disney's strategy is fascinating and kind of multivaried in ways that I think is better than what Warner Brothers was trying to do. Because Warner Brothers really is just in the, like, content delivery business.
Yes.
They have cable properties that are all depreciating in value. They have... The theatrical business has always been hit or miss. And
it's been good this year for them.
Yeah.
Good, great year this year. I mean, we're not
this year, right? Just this year.
I mean, you know, I
couldn't say just this year, but I'm specifically talking about this
year. Yeah. They're doing very well right now. What Warner Brothers does is different than what Disney does and what Universal does to a certain extent, right? Those are kind of two separate things. So I like Warner Brothers. I do think there is the urge to be a giant streamer like Netflix makes much more sense for a Warner Brothers than for some other companies.
Sure. I still think the rush to be Netflix for everyone has been insane.
I hate to sound like a filthy communist here, but I do think more companies should be like comfortable making sustainable, smaller levels of profit. Again, the thing that's always been most infuriating about the treatment of HBO over the last decade or so is when the AT&T buys Warner Brothers. And one of the things that John Stankey at the time is like, we want HBO to be competing for hours eyeballs viewed, and like, that's not what HBO does, and it doesn't need to be what it does, because HBO makes like $2.7 billion a year. Like, that's a lot of money for one channel to be generating in profit, not even revenue, profit. Anyway, it drives me crazy. That is not enough, but of course it isn't.
I'll slightly tweak your demand for companies to do something smaller and more sustainable. I think sustainable is correct, but the thing is that you want brands to expand by doing the thing they do well and doing more of it, not by doing something that is different than the thing they are good at. You don't hire the Across the Movie Aisle podcast to, I don't know, like run an auction like service or something, right? Like in theory, we could all stand up on stage and like sort of talk through things and like, you know, oh, there's memorabilia, yeah. Right? but we kind of have that skill set, but it's like really not actually what we're good at and what we do. And you would, and like asking HBO to be a mass market, sort of low engagement, high volume content shop. It's deploying the resources in a way that doesn't make any sense for the skill set that you have. And so one thing to say, what we want from HBO is more and more profits and bigger, right? Like, and more revenue, like, okay, like demand they do even better, but you can't demand that they do even better by doing a completely different thing that isn't their core skill set and also turns off the people who love them.
Yeah. I mean, I just think there's like a size limit to a thing like HBO, where if you are chasing that higher level audience.
To some degree, that's obviously true at the same time, right? Like you're not going to be making, for the most part, if you're HBO, the thing that you do, especially with your drama, with your scripted series, is you're not going to be making shows for 70% of the country. You're going to be making shows that are primarily targeted at something like 10 to 30% of the country. Like at the bare minimum, you are like your target audience. I don't want to say like literally everyone who watches the show is going to meet this description, but your target audience is going to be people with a college degree. And then it's probably actually going to be a smaller subset than that even, right? So that limits you already to like something like a third of the country and then a smaller subset than that. But even if you can expand that audience a little, you can also find ways to monetize your audience because they're highly engaged. And this is like the thing that they didn't think about, I think, or they didn't think about enough, is that the best way, like when you have a somewhat small but super highly engaged and relatively affluent audience, the thing to do isn't discard them for a much bigger, less affluent, less engaged audience. It's to try and get more money out of those people who already have $20 or $25 a month. Try to make it more like your average, like try to make your average more like $35 a month somehow or another by upselling them on premium services, or I don't know, freaking t-shirts and hats like A24 does. It's not exactly the same strategy, but like there's ways to do this that like understand that your core audience is willing to spend money on you because they really like you, and target those people and get more revenue out of them. That's the thing you're good at, is getting people to like you a lot by creating high quality stuff that appeals specifically to them.
All right. Exit question. How long until HBO Max changes names again? Peter?
I don't know. I figure HBO Max probably going to change names less often than Trump changes tariff policy, but still like on the same kind of, right? Didn't I read that he's changed tariff policy like 53 times in 110 days or something like that? Anyway, so probably less frequently than that. At the same time, like the HBO Max name change game is kind of like the Trump tariff policy. You wake up each day and you don't know what it's going to be.
Alyssa.
32 months.
Alyssa gives an actual answer.
Over under, I will say like 24 and a half months. We'll put it at that. Because that's about the average here. So HBO Max Plus coming soon, I'm sure. All right.
That's like 235 Trump tariff changes.
All right. Make sure to swing by Bulwark Plus for our bonus episode on Friday. We're going to be previewing the summer blockbuster season. Always fun. Summer previews, everybody that's hot, you want to spend some time in a air-conditioned movie theater, it's going to be great. Have a nice drink and some popcorn, etc. All right, on to the main event. Friendship, the new cringe-inducing comedy from starring Tim Robinson and Paul Rudd. Fans of Tim Robinson's cult sketch comedy show, I Think You Should Leave, will find much to love here, as Friendship plays kind of like a 90-minute sketch from an episode of that show. And I will say, the audience I saw this movie with was very much expecting this vibe. Like, the moment Tim Robinson showed up on, just like they saw his face on screen, they were starting to giggle. So you know, I had a very good viewing experience with this. I just want to set the stage here. Robinson plays Craig, a kind of very lonely guy, but I don't think he realizes quite how lonely he is. He's living in the suburbs with his cancer survivor wife, played by Kate Mara, and a teenage son. He doesn't really have friends, but he seems mostly okay with that, at least until Paul Rudd's Austin Carmichael moves in a few doors down. Austin is a local weatherman. He's very charming, and he takes a liking to Craig. He invites him over to his house. They go on adventures through the sewer system and the woods and the forest, and he puts him on the guest list for his garage band's local shows. Needless to say, this does not last. Craig is, to put it bluntly, kind of a weirdo. He's a weirdo. He just doesn't understand how to behave in social settings. He doesn't understand how to jibe with people, right? He doesn't get that he is a weirdo. He doesn't understand it. And this is absolutely, again, it's a movie that puts the cringe in cringe comedy. And this is Robinson's particular brand of genius, right? The thing that has made him something of a viral superstar. He has this habit of creating characters who are weird without being cruel or relatable. Meaning we don't hate guys like Craig when we see them on the screen, but we also can't really empathize with them. They're just too off-putting. We just kind of don't want to be around them. And that's a weird pitch for a movie, right? Here's 90 minutes with a guy you don't want to be around. But that's kind of why this works. I don't know. I have trouble describing how certain kinds of comedy work, right? Like, how do you describe the way Tim Robinson moves his shoulders and how that sparks waves of laughter amongst, again, my paid preview audience? He's got like a funny sort of look about him. And writing about comedy is hard because there is something unguarded about humor, right? The things that make you laugh out loud, or like do, like I have like kind of an unrestrained snort that I will do. And this is a movie that inspired a lot of those out of me. I have not laughed this much in a theater in a long time. It's not humor that's based on clever joke writing or witty wordplay. It's not intellectualized, really. It's more visceral, kind of a attraction repulsion that screams awkward hilarity, at least to me. Alyssa, you texted us from the movie theater. By the way, bad movie theater etiquette. You texted us that you were going to walk out. You were like, I can't take any more of this. This is too awkward for me.
I texted you that I was 8 minutes into the movie and I was tempted to gouge my eyes out.
And I think I'm kind of curious how common that experience is going to be with this film. Like, what were the vibes like with the rest of the audience when you watched it? Was there anybody else in the theater? Because you were in like an afternoon, you know, screening.
No, there were definitely people there. And I've been thinking about this movie a little bit. And I wonder, to a certain extent, if my reaction to it and to this class of comedy has something to do with gender. Because I don't like cringe comedy in general. And I was thinking about like the one line in this movie that did make me laugh when Craig, it's just like, I guess this is a spoiler, decides to like attempt to recreate his wacky adventure with Austin in the sewers by taking his like cancer survivor wife down there. And she like, he gets lost, he loses her, he's home, the cops are like, where is your wife? And he's like, she's in the sewers. And I laughed. But I also think that I wonder if watching this movie, if Craig seems like, if not totally harmless, like someone who's just like, he's a nuisance, right? Whereas I think part of the reason that I don't find this humor sort of as funny as you guys do, or even really bearable, is that I think about what it would be like to deal with this kind of guy if his affection, if his attention and affection were sort of fixated on me. And feels a lot scarier. Like, you know, I've not been the subject of this kind of person often in my life. But the idea of having someone sort of with that few social skills and that level of sort of persistence fixated on you as a woman does not feel funny to me. And I think like, in a way, one of the most fantastical things about the movie is the extent to which Craig's wife is just like, you know what? I'm going to leave. Like, I'm, you know, it's like this sort of wish fulfillment that, like, she could be like, I am getting out of this marriage and booking it and not be worried that he was going to, like, track her down or stalk her or just, like, sort of refuse to let go in some way. And I think that I'm not saying that this is like the right reaction to have or what's intended, but I just like, I found it much harder to enjoy this movie, knowing what it would be like to try and navigate a situation like that as a woman.
Do you like Curb Your Enthusiasm, Alyssa?
No.
Yeah. See, and what's interesting about both this and Curb is that both Larry David and Tim Robinson are very specifically playing not physically threatening individuals.
Well,
right? Like there's not really anything in the behavior. There's this, again, kind of spoilers, I guess. There's this one moment where he's doing like garage boxing that turns violent, like very quickly, but also is more a function of him not understanding the setting.
Well, he does wave a gun at a bunch of people later in the film. If I want to make the case that he has a kind of that violent, like a threatening nature to him,
right? But he does that very again. If you don't want to know the plot of the movie, stop listening. But he does that. he does the gun waving thing because he's trying to give Austin time to put his hairpiece back on.
No, he pulls the gun out before the hairpiece comes.
Yeah,
he definitely pulls out the gun before the hairpiece comes off. He then escalates the gun waving and makes a show of it to try and save him. And it's this weird moment of like quasi redemption, sort of the way the film portrays it, but also not. But he has the gun out in a way that like we're on the one hand supposed to understand that he's not really there to shoot anybody. On the other hand, if you're in that situation, forget the male-female aspect of this. Any human being with somebody who is obviously disturbed is not quite right, but doesn't read social cues well, doesn't fully have control of himself and has a gun out, like that is a threat of violence there. And I didn't have the reaction that Alyssa had, but I don't think it's right to say that he doesn't, that there's no threat of physical, there's no physical threat present.
Yeah, and I would also just say like, just because Tim Robinson or Larry David aren't like huge or muscly. Like I'm 5'4", like I'm under 5'4". I'm not that big. Like what is unnerving about someone who behaves like this character is not like their size or their stature, but their unpredictability. Yeah. Again, like I'm not saying you're wrong to find it funny. I just like, I think I am, you know, for a lot of reasons, many of which are too complicated to go into on a lighthearted movie podcast, I am not capable of finding this kind of thing funny.
Okay, that's fair. This is kind of what I mean when I say that humor is more revealing than often reactions to other types of movies can be. I think there are reasons that comedy either works or doesn't work.
Yeah,
that are deeply personal.
I think a lot of women have experienced something where like a guy behaved badly or said something that was like carried an air of menace and then was like told it was a joke. And I don't even think this is like poorly done necessarily. It's not something I am able to resonate with.
Okay. Fair enough. Peter, what did you make of Friendship?
I had very mixed feelings about this. On the one hand, this is a movie that I kind of admired and even liked in many ways. On the other hand, I didn't actually laugh at this movie except like literally only one time. And it was the scene in the sewers where they've got the police in there and they're trying to. And so there's like a weird jump that has to happen because so much of this movie is built around just like incredibly awkward physical comedy and like just the awkwardness of doing anything and how he just can't move in a normal way. Even like bits where he is, there's a bit near the end of the movie where he is carting a drum set down the street and that just like plays this whole, I wouldn't say it's impossible to describe, but he just can't cart the drums. He can't pull the cart full of drums in a normal way. It flummoxes him. It confuses him. He is baffled by this whole thing. So anyway, there's a bunch of that. And but there's a bit in this bit in the sequence where the police are down in the sewers looking for his wife, trying to figure out what's going on. And they have to get the police dog up over the into the thing. And there's this like Belgian Malamute police dog who they just have to like awkwardly like butt shift over the hump. And it's like, couldn't help it because it's so innocent and so natural. And I love dogs and it was very funny. That was the one moment that I laughed at, but I didn't actually, there was no guffawing, not even like a little chuckle like anywhere else through this movie. I was sort of fascinated by it, but it didn't cause me to laugh in any way. So in that way, it sort of failed as a comedy. But I kind of respect and admire this film because I think for what it is, it's really quite well done. And it's the kind of humor that I tend to prefer versus the sort of clever jokes kind of you know, like twisty punchlines and wordplay type humor can be funny, but it's not quite Coen Brothers-esque, but it's in the vein of the Coen Brothers, because what it relies on is this idea that some people are naturally funny, and it's not jokes per se. It is the natural comedy of the fact that humans are strange and bizarre and sometimes off-putting. But if you have the safety and the distance of being in a movie theater and not actually being in the room with someone like this, you can laugh at the, you can like, there's a, you can be amused by their oddness. And this is something that you see in the Coen Brothers filmography pretty frequently, is that there are just bizarre characters whose humor comes from the fact that they are being themselves, intensely themselves, in a way that sometimes actually is sort of violent and off-putting and strange. You can think of Nicolas Cage in Raising Arizona, you know, with a stocking mask over his head, like stealing a package of Huggies with a gun at a 7-Eleven type, you know, convenience store, right? I mean, there's definitely violence inherent in that. He's already kidnapped a baby. And so that's the kind of, when I like comedies, it tends to be that sort of thing. This one just didn't move me in that way. And so I sort of found myself like studying this film rather than like being deeply lost at it or just sort of reacting to it in a kind of like, oh, this is a, in the way that you're sort of supposed to. And I was really kind of impressed with a lot of what sort of the filmmaking craft of this film. It doesn't call attention to the way that it's shot, for example. This isn't sort of showy. At the same time, look at the way that this movie is lit and the way that the color schema shifts from scene to scene and sometimes even shot to shot. You'll get these deep reds and then these big greens. You get this, like the whole thing has this like gorgeous sort of like weird kind of almost depressive Midwestern low light affect to it, right? Like you're sort of perpetually stuck in Indiana and in you know, an early February day where it's overcast, and just like there's this oddness to some of the production design, where on the one hand they are obviously in present day or pretty close to it because they have phones, because our main character works for an app development company. On the other hand, you go into these houses and they sort of seem like they've been pulled from like maybe 1990, but also maybe 1978. And it's some sort of weird amalgamation of these things. And this design scheme, right? Like the production design just sort of throws you off and puts you in this kind of odd emotional place that like Greg Waterman comes from, that helps sort of sell a lot of the weirdness that's on the screen. And it's so different than the kind of Will Ferrell or just kind of mainstream studio comedy mode of the 1990s and the aughts. A lot of those comedies that I just didn't love, they're so bright, they're so overlit, they're so sort of slick and conventional. And this just isn't that. And so on a craft level, I really liked this film. And also just, I liked its willingness to let its hero be kind of unlikable and to be awkward and to be difficult. And that is not maybe, you know, maybe you're scared of him, but like, I think for most people, certainly in the theater I was in, they found him sort of, it's like what you said, Sonny, he's not somebody who they like. On the other hand, they find this interaction from a safe distance really quite amusing. There were clearly a lot of like fans of this guy in the theater that I saw this movie in downtown Boston over the weekend. It was a nearly full theater on a Sunday afternoon, which was kind of interesting. And so there is this way in which I admire the way that this movie was made, but I didn't quite, it didn't get to me in the way that I think it did with you, Sonny.
It is very intentionally a kind of off-putting brand of humor. Like, I mean, it is designed to be weird and kind of uncomfortable.
When I was much younger and I was like, making movies. This is like a very grandiose term for like, I was doing some digital video stuff with some other folks who were quite young. And we would like playing around with Adobe Premiere back when it was relatively new. Like, it was film major in college, that sort of thing, at least for a little while, didn't graduate from it. Anyway, but I made stuff and there is a, like, this was the kind of humor that we were shooting for at the time, right? Like, we were shooting for stuff that wasn't sort of straightforward jokes. There's a lot of editing humor in this movie, right? There's this incredible, like, just perfect cut away from him, like, absolutely, like, screaming, like, sort of, like, erratically and crazily in that sewer scene with the police. It just, like, gives us just a flash of it and then, like, pulls away and it's, like, suddenly quiet. Right. And like a lot of this movie like, sort of like built around that kind of like off rhythm editing humor, almost like a sort of like a little bit of jazz where you're playing behind the beat, except it's not meant to be cool. It's meant to just sort of throw you off. Since Alyssa mentioned this, like her sort of watching this as a woman, I'll talk about watching this as a man, because this the thing that bugged me about this was the way the movie has been described by other critics. And even marketed, and in some ways, the film itself like gestures at this in one single line as some sort of referendum on like the problems with masculinity. And there is this line in the film that's like, this is why men shouldn't have friends, because I can't remember what it follows up, but it's like, because things will get all screwed up is like the gist of what he says after that, right? I can't remember the exact line. I know that's not it, but this is why men shouldn't have friends. But the rest of the movie doesn't really deal with the question of why men as a category shouldn't have friends. This is a movie that is very specifically about why this one guy can't make friends.
Right, right.
And in fact, what you see is that other men in this movie do have something like, I don't know if they're like deep or like highly, or sort of like if they're sharing their pain with each other, but like do basically have friendly associates. And I've seen like critics treat this as like a referendum on like what's wrong with men, and it's just like this movie doesn't give
you
anything.
What's wrong with this one man?
It's very specifically this movie gives you absolutely no way to tie this one guy's weirdness to other men, unless you just assume that all male protagonists are referendums on men as a category.
Yeah, no. This is actually one of my favorite things about the movie, which is that I agree with you totally, Peter, that this is not a referendum on male friendship, because there's a version of this movie where everybody is annoying and alienated and like nobody really has any relationships with anyone. And that's
like Fight Club is a referendum on male friendship, like on men as a category.
Sure. But time and again, we see that is not the case. That is literally every other character and group of characters has their own kind of friend set, has relationships with people that at least appear like congenial. Craig is the only one repeatedly who we see again and again. And I think there is a fairly profound statement in there, but it is, if you find yourself in a situation where you are having trouble repeatedly making friends, maybe look inward. Like that is, it's not them, it's you problem. But that is also an awkward thing to tell the friendless out there. You know, that is a hard thing to say.
Wow, Sonny, I didn't realize you were going to talk to me like that.
I'm just saying, if you find yourself in a situation where you're waving a gold gun around and everybody isn't sure how you got there, you know, think about how you got to that situation. That's all I'm saying. All right. So what do we think? Thumbs up or thumbs down on friendship? Peter.
I'll give this a thumbs up because I admired it so much. But I'll also say, again, I laughed exactly one time.
Okay. Alyssa.
I remember two other occasions in which I laughed in this movie. The first being the scene where this guy's like, "Win!" And by the way, we should still be in Afghanistan, which did kind of crack me up. And then also the anticlimactic toad venom trip. I feel like I would give this a thumbs up if you know this is your thing, and a thumbs down if you either know it's not or are unsure.
Yeah, that sounds about right. I give it a thumbs up. Funniest movie of the year I've seen. I can't imagine this movie won't make my top 10 just because I don't think I'll see a funnier movie this year, because Hollywood doesn't really make comedies anymore.
You think we should still be in Afghanistan. That's why it's
well, that, and that actor is another very funny internet comic, by the way. Connor O'Malley is his name. He has like his own kind of cult following and he's very funny in this. Anyway, thumbs up again. If you are a fan of I Think You Should Leave, obviously this will be very much your jam. And if you're not, maybe, you know, you're gonna have trouble with it. So take that as the advice we give you. All right, that is it for today's show. Many thanks to our producer, Rupert Vanderstam, without whom this program would sound much worse. Make sure to swing by Bulwark Plus on Friday for our bonus episode. Tell your friends. A strong recommendation from a friend is basically the only way to grow podcast audiences. If we don't grow, we'll die. If you did not love today's episode, please complain to me on Twitter at Sunny Bunch. I'll convince you that this is, in fact, the best show in your podcast feed. See you guys on Friday.